Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her Podcast. Welcome to our show. Hey, it's episode 474. It's a whole lot of talking. As we share the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, what's the connection between exercise and cancer? Aha, caught you on that one. All right, so hold that thought because I know that this is going to be a very special show for you. Before we begin, just know that this episode is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y Vitamins. These are vitamins, minerals, and herbs rooted in nature, and they have a special gift for women, the award-winning Her Life Stages products. And these provide support for the menstrual years, including PMS, ouch, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause. It's an integrative, holistic approach to having a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. Hey, if you want to learn more about Her Life Stages, run on over to your local health food store. Check it out at solaray.com using promo code HER20 for 20% off. You'll be glad you did. All right, here's a reminder to click on iTunes to rate and review today's show because we just sit around here, the Her Podcast team, waiting for your feedback. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Now look, you know me, I rant and rave all about physical activity. You know, you'll never hear the end of it from me. So, one of the nuances to this is what do you do if you have a diagnosis of cancer? I can tell you right now that as a physician trained in the old school, I was taught that if someone has cancer, it's like you treat them extremely carefully. You know, please stay in bed, rest all the time, et cetera, et cetera. Only to find out that when I had the absolute pleasure of meeting Dr. Catherine Schmitz, that she turned this whole thing on its head. And she said, no. She wrote a book called Moving Through Cancer, an exercise and strength training program for the fight of your life. Empowers patients and caregivers in 5 steps. All right, you got me at what? Exercise and cancer? Good heavens. All right. So Dr. Schmitz is a professor in the Division of Hematology Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. If I read all of her accolades, I'd be here for about an hour and a half. So I'm going to cut to the chase. All right. So she's the director of exercise oncology. This is the exercise oncology initiative for the Hillman Center for Cancer. And what is all this about? So, Katie, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Hey, Pam, how are you?
Hey. So we're going to start from the very beginning because this is so cutting edge. And I know that many people in the Her Podcast audience carry a diagnosis of cancer wherever they are in that journey. How did you get so interested in the connection between cancer and physical activity?
Yeah. So when I was doing my postdoc at the University of Minnesota, I was working in the area of obesity prevention, metabolic disease, heart disease. And one of my faculty mentors asked if I had ever looked into the possibility of working on exercise and cancer. And, you know, I think I answered, well, I can spell cancer. I don't know anything about it. But I did, like any good postdoc, I went to the library and, you know, spent some quality time back when we actually went to the library, Pam.
Wait a minute. Library? Wait, what?
Yes, that's how old I am. I actually went to a physical library and read things. And spent about 3 weeks doing a deep dive into understanding what we know and what we don't know about exercise and cancer. And what I found was that we were really on the cusp of a brand new field. And it was, you know, a really exciting prospect to think about being part of the foundational work that forms a new field of science. And so I started talking to some oncologists at Minnesota to say, you know, would you work with me? And there was one in particular, Doug Yee, who is now head of the University of Minnesota Cancer Center, who said, great, let's go, let's do this. And we wrote a grant to the Susan G. Komen Foundation. We were awarded that grant. That was the first study that I did in exercise and cancer, and I'd never look back.
How interesting. And for everyone out there, the Susan G. Komen Foundation is associated with the Race for the Cure for Breast Cancer. And I was the co-director in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. So really major shout out to that foundation. And so what did you find? Were you shocked? Were you surprised? Was there a there when you started delving into all of this?
Yeah. So that first study, you know, would be subtitled Science is Fickle, because, you know, we went into it saying we were interested in understanding whether strength training in particular could alter metabolism in a way that would reduce risk for breast cancer recurrence in these cancer survivors, breast cancer survivors in particular. And we had this nuisance variable that we had to deal with called lymphedema, which is a common adverse effect of breast cancer surgeries and radiation. And it turned out the most interesting findings coming out of the study were about lymphedema. And so we actually wrote a much larger trial that was funded by the National Cancer Institute called PAL that was game-changing for women who have had any kind of nodes removed or damage to the lymphatic system as a result of breast cancer. The advice prior to my work was never lift anything heavier than 5 to 15 pounds ever again in your life, ever. No suitcase, no grandchild, no case of water, no Christmas ornaments, no bag of soil, no bathroom tiles. Like, think of all the things we pick up. We pick things up, right? We redo our bathrooms. We decorate our houses. We care for children. We do all of the things, right? We are women. So what do you mean I'm not supposed to lift anything for the rest of my life? We actually reversed that advice. All of the advice on the National Cancer Institute website, Susan Komen website, American Cancer Society website, National Lymphedema Network website, all changed as a result of my work to say that in fact, slowly progressive resistance training was not only safe, but it was actually good for the lymphatic system.
Did you get pushback?
You know, I was actually really shocked that we published the results in JAMA and New England Journal, and some major medical oncologists and surgical oncologists commented on the results in the New York Times, saying that this was a major landslide finding, that we really needed to change the way that we're treating women. So no, I was actually really, I was very surprised because it was a 180 and the field said, yay. It didn't say, what do you mean? It said, yay. Now there's a trickle down, right? So that work happened a decade ago, Cam, and we're still trying to educate community oncologists, right? So those folks are not reading New England Journal of Medicine. They're not reading JAMA. So how do we get the information to them? I'm sure that you've talked about this on your show, the 17-year span between when you have, you know, positive clinical trial results and when it's actually disseminated. You know, we're not at 17 years yet. And so it's not fully disseminated, but it is pretty broadly disseminated at this point. So it's great news.
Yeah. And I think another reason why a lot of the providers are probably welcoming this along this 17-year journey and the rest of it is because what they would hear from women is like, what are you, nuts? You know, I got a garden, you moron. So I just, you know, come on now, grow up, you know, and I look terrible because I can't lift and I can't, you know, get physically active and all my friends are like at the Y hanging and whatever. And then meanwhile, I also know friends who've said, the hell with that lymphedema thing. And I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And guess what? They're doing just fine. And so if all of that's true, what up? So what you did was you actually provided these medical practitioners and all the teams with the data to be able to say, hey, it's okay. So you gave them the go button. So they hit the little green thing and off they went and back and forth. When you were doing the trials, I'm really curious because I know that there are a lot of women out there who are probably like hesitant because maybe they haven't heard from their provider and all the rest of it. What did you find? What did you observe as a senior investigator in these studies in terms of the acceptance of the women who were participants in the trials? I mean, were they scared? Were they hesitant? Were they, oh my gosh, I'm not sure? Or were they like, bring it on, you know?
Yeah, no, they felt like they were wrapped in cotton wool because we organized the trial to ensure that there were double and triple checks on every aspect of their safety. So this is why the program, which is now called Strength After Breast Cancer, and people can find it online, the program is now offered by physical therapists, Pam, not so much by exercise trainers, because we want it to be done in a clinical setting. And we need to make sure that people are starting with very low weights and progressing their weights very slowly. We need to make sure that if there's a change in symptoms, that there is appropriate evaluation and treatment if there's any kind of issue that arises. So this is a clinical population, and we want to acknowledge that while the risk is low, the risk is not zero. And so we do need to make sure that people do this in a way that this should not be translated to great news, go be a bodybuilder right now. That is not what I've said.
Right. And you know, I think it's really smart working through physical therapists because it's insurance reimbursable.
Exactly.
So you get an RX from the provider and then you're off and running because, I mean, you do have the diagnosis of cancer. And obviously everyone needs PT associated with so many of the manifestations of that whole cancer journey. So I think that that's absolutely brilliant. Curious, why not start with aerobic exercise?
So it actually arose out of work that I did prior to switching into working on cancer. I was really interested in strength training for women in particular. So my first R01, my first big study was actually funded by NIDDK and was focused on obesity prevention. I was really interested in the potential for using resistance training to alter body composition, to increase muscle mass in a way that would help women to avoid those small yearly weight gains that tend to happen as we go through perimenopause and menopause. So I did a 2-year-long trial with 160 women. And, you know, we did just twice weekly strength training, nothing but strength training. And we actually were able to show that, in fact, we did benefit their body composition with just twice a week exercise. We didn't do any aerobic exercise. And we did actually prevent small yearly gains, particularly in visceral fat, which, as you know, is the fat that is most dangerous for us in terms of metabolic health. And that effect was actually greater in Black women in the study than in the white women in the study, interestingly. But unfortunately, not for the reason that you might assume. And unfortunately, it was because the Black women in the control group had an enormous increase in visceral fat over the time of the 2 years of the study. And the women who were in the intervention group did not. And so the effect was a prevention of an increase in visceral fat. And so I came into my work about exercise and cancer already really fascinated with the idea of using resistance training in order to alter body composition and metabolism. And it was very clear to me that there were very few people in the area of exercise and cancer. Well, there were very few people in the area of exercise and cancer at all at that point, but there were even fewer who were focused on resistance training. And so it became kind of a hook for me. It became sort of a way for me to differentiate myself. And all of my work, all the way through my entire career, has focused on strength training for women.
You're singing to the choir. I'm a resistance trained nutcase. And as a triathlete and the rest of it, I'm like, you know, bring it on. And I've always been about, you know, kind of what we call now, I suppose, recomposition, not just body composition, but we're going to take the little mess that we are today, ladies, and we're going to recompose this, but this time methodically and strategically. And I also think that, you know, so much of this is generational too. Young women now are actually getting strength training as part of their what's left of physical education in their schools and the rest of it. But it's not foreign. It's like, ooh, you know, what's that? And I think as you kind of progress through all of the, you know, millennials, and then you move to Gen X, and Gen X was kind of plus minus, and then forget the boomers. I mean, they never even had a chance, but now they're circling back and they're getting smarter about the whole thing. I just think that you were way ahead of your time, really looking at that strength training thing, which is amazing because we now have such a breadth of knowledge on how powerful it is to establish a strong body composition foundation, especially as we age. The average age of many of your study participants, I would imagine, was 50 plus. So the reason why I bring that up is another thing that you know extremely well, and that is the what we call the sarcopenia of the seventh decade of life. I don't care if you're a master's athlete or who you are, you will have an age-related drop in lean body mass, which is muscle mass. However, if you enter your 60s, which is the seventh decade of life, you know, fairly high on that muscle mass quantity, then when you drop a little because of age, you know, it's like, huh, so what? But if you're rolling into your 60s with rotten lean body mass quantity, then when you drop, then all of a sudden we're kind of peering closer to frailty, which is, you know, the one thing that makes me feel crazy, because there's no going back. Once you're frail, you're frail. And it's very tough to turn that little Hummer around. So this is why, especially working with the demographic you're working with, resistance training is absolutely critical to being able to do, first of all, maintain independence, get out of a chair. Try doing that 10 times right now and not holding on with your hands. If you could do that, good for you. But if you don't have the muscles in your quads and your hamstrings and your glutes, yeah, good luck with that. And also, if you fall, who's going to get you up? There's no front end loader waiting for you. You know, it's all about you. And so this is all the more reason why when you came up with this, you know, beautiful concept of linking physical activity and cancer, I said, you know, the demographic alone is going to sell me. You know, if this was all about 18-year-olds, that's one thing. But this is, generally speaking, older women per se in a big way. So you speak to both women and men. So it's cancer for everybody, cancer and exercise for everybody, which is so terribly important. And on the aerobic end of it, hey, we can walk.
We can. And that is primarily what I ask people to do in my trials. I am a fan of doing a lot of supervision and direction for the strength training, because I think that while it sounds very straightforward to you and I, because we've been doing it for a long time, I think people get overwhelmed very quickly. And so I think, you know, saying basically walking into the interaction with patients to say, okay, now pick up 10-pound weight. Now I want you to do the following movement. I mean, basically guiding people through it until it becomes really, really like, okay, I really know what I'm doing. And even then, behaviorally, we don't do the same thing, strength training alone, that we do when we're in the presence of other people doing strength training. We just don't. It's just a fact of human nature. But aerobic exercise is more natural to people. It's more, you know, go for a walk. That's pretty easy. That's pretty straightforward. So I don't supervise the aerobic exercise in my trials in the way that I supervise strength training, but I do check on people. I do put monitors on them, on their wrists, and I ask them to check in, and, you know, we monitor what we see on that Fitbit or Apple Watch or whatever. You know, we monitor it so that we can come back and see, I see that you didn't do much walking this past week. Is something going on? So that we can have a conversation. So there's an accountability that goes with trying to get the exercise to happen, but they're asked to do the aerobic exercise all around.
I think women forget that they've been lifting weights all their life. It's called babies. It's called hauling stuff in your car.
Exactly.
It's just, you know, It's a functional piece of life. So we just sort of rock and roll through life and it's all good. And then as we get older, it's like there's less of that to a certain degree. It doesn't have to be that way, but it just sort of turns out that way as we suddenly, you know, become best friends with remote controls and things like this. And then when we're offered the easier way, we take it. You know, there's the escalator and then there's the stairs and the whole thing. So I think it's not foreign to women. They're just unaware of the fact they've actually been lifting weights all that time. Now they're doing it less functionally, but in a more focused way. Now, what I like to do is link them. So I'll give you an example. So I had a woman stare at me and she goes, "Why am I doing these bicep things? Like, what's up with that? I mean, it's just like what? I don't want to join the Miss Olympia." And she wasn't getting the whole reason why. "So what? I'm stronger and whatever." I said, "Okay, here. What I want you to do is pick up a 25-pound bag of dog kibble. I have two German shepherds. You know, all I have to do is lift that stuff all day. I don't even have to ever see the inside of a gym." So I said, "Try to do that just, you know, for grins and come back and report." She goes, "Holy God." And I said, "Bingo. You see, if you do those biceps curls and you're helping build a stronger base there, then it translates into functional rewards like being able to lift your groceries, being able to get that, you know, kibble bag, all the stuff that goes on during the day that you sometimes blow off like, no, I'll get someone else to do that. Why? Come on, grow a set. You could do this." And so this is the reason why. So all of a sudden she was like, light went off, like, whoa. And then she kind of felt like, you know, once she was able to lift that 25-pound bag, she was like, "I'm bad. I'm really bad. I'm badass. And I can do this. Who needs anybody to help me?" And it was like, whoa, you know, now there's a mind-body transformation for you. So I like to kind of make it more practical so they understand. And the one thing that I usually love to play with is the fall. Now, obviously, you don't want to fall. That's a bad thing. And as you get older, that probability increases fairly precipitously, especially if you're not strong in your legs and your body, you know, because you have to have the whole core balance and everything. So, you know, when you look at the morbidity, mortality data on falls, it's not great, especially, you know, when you're breaking a hip and all the rest of it. So what I love to have people do is practice doing push-ups. Now, I don't mean you have to do some big straight leg push-up that's going to end up on TikTok or something. No, just do bent knee push-ups, do them off the wall, wherever you can do it. You know, there's a lot of creative iterations on this one. Why? Because you may fall, you may trip, whatever, and nobody's around. How are you going to get up? There's a ton of videos out there that kind of show how you roll over and you do all kinds of interesting ways to be able to get yourself up. But you have to have the strength to do that, to save your own life, to save your own life. So that usually, you know, most people stop then. They go, "Whoa, whoa, wait a minute. You got me at save your own life." And then you kind of go to that. So that being said, that usually is a starting point for people because immediately it's not just functional. It's like save your own life. I don't know. What do you think of that?
So I think that what you're talking about is highly relevant to anybody over the age of 50. And I think it becomes that much more relevant to people who've had a diagnosis of cancer because we can very reliably predict that if somebody does not exercise as they go through their cancer treatment, they will lose function. We can document that they will lose muscle mass. We can document that there will be an increase in fat mass. And so, you know, functional decline is the expectation. And we know, and we have documented in my work, that we can prevent that decline by doing strength training, by doing aerobic exercise as people are going through their treatment and in survivorship.
Yeah, I just think that it's so important for people to make the connection. And you're doing that. in your book, tell me, when someone opens up your book, and this is that beautiful book, Moving Through Cancer, what are they first going to see? Are they going to start wrapping their head around the importance mentally and physically? What if they're scared? What if they're, oh, what if I hurt myself? You know?
So the first thing that's offered within the book is my story. You know, I am a primary caregiver for a head and neck cancer survivor. I talk about the experience of going through that process of the shock of diagnosis and leading up to the treatments and recognizing where exercise could be helpful and getting the exercise to help and the benefits that we saw anecdotally. I mean, this is obviously, you know, an N of one, not a research study, as a result of the exercise that was done during treatment and in recovery. So they're gonna hear other people's stories. So we interviewed a lot of cancer patients and survivors in order to get many voices, men, women, older, younger, to talk about their experience of what it felt like to go through the diagnosis of cancer. And so they're met first in the first chapters with hopefully seeing themselves on the page, you know, seeing, oh yes, that's like my experience. And then we lay out a plan, and the plan walks people from the point of diagnosis through their survivorship to make sure that they have a roadmap to be able to maintain their function and maintain their proper body composition as they go through their treatment and through their survivorship.
What kind of physical activity do they start with? Obviously, I would assume that you're going to say, now, don't stop walking. That's really important and all the rest of it. But with regard to the strength training, how do you get them convinced it's important?
So we start with prehabilitation, which is the idea that you've been diagnosed and you have a period of time before you're going to start whatever treatment is the first treatment for you. And during that time, what we know is that even if it's only 3 weeks, 2 weeks, we know that we can make an enormous difference in recovery from that first insult. Usually it's surgery, and the ability to get out of the hospital, the ability to get back to normal daily life, if we push as hard as we can with our strength training and aerobic exercise and proper nutrition with pushing protein in particular. So I'm convincing people by giving them examples and talking to them about people who have done rehabilitation to show them that this is valuable. Once they're done with their surgery, we drop the strength training completely for a period of a couple of months, basically, depending on the severity of the surgery. But surgery, as you know, Pam, there's a lot of physical work that goes on in repairing the body after a surgery. And so we need to let the body heal. There is a guideline in there about, you know, how much exercise you should be doing and how much you want to avoid overdoing so that you don't make wound healing slower. And so we do need to really titrate exercise and focus on just walking at that time. Then once we get into the adjuvant treatments, we pick the weights back up again. So we get back into the weight training. I have recommended in the book a very, very simple strength training regimen that includes just 5 exercises. We don't need 10, 20 exercises to build muscle and maintain muscle. We need to do a small number of exercises repeatedly.
So what are those 5 exercises? We want to know right now.
Squats, lunges, deadlifts, then a pull and a push. So basically, all I'm working on is chest and back. We don't get into shoulders and biceps and triceps. We're trying to be very, very, very simple so that we get people moving. If people get moving and they want to learn more, that's fantastic. But this is basically giving people the basics: a pushing exercise, a pulling exercise, and then sitting to the chair and up. So a squat, basically, and a lunge, and then a deadlift. So we're working all of the major muscle groups of the lower body. And we're asking people to get some kind of resistance. If what you've got right now is body weight, you start with the body weight. And once you get used to the exercises, then you head out to Target and get yourself a couple of dumbbells. And when those get easy, go buy some more. If you want to get fancy, buy some adjustable dumbbells. So all of these are things that can be done at home. You can start with, you know, water bottles. You know, it doesn't matter. You don't need to go out and buy fancy equipment to be able to.
Or bands. Bands and tubing, which, you know, I think are fabulous because number one, they're cheap, but they're very effective if done well. Now, that's an interesting point. So where are the exercise professionals, the fitness professionals who know how to do this safely? Many women have this nightmare of meeting up with some fitness professional who's, you know, working with halfbacks with the Raiders. You know, you're like, no. So where do you find these people?
Great news. We have made a directory of exercise oncology professionals and cancer rehabilitation professionals across the United States. If you Google for moving through cancer and then ACSM, American College of Sports Medicine. So put in moving through cancer, ACSM, the directory will come right up and you can click on the big green button and then put in your state, put in your location, and it will show you all of the opportunities for exercise in your area. One of the things that you could choose to do on that directory is to say that you're open to online opportunities.
There you go.
And then that opens up the door. There are a lot of places. We actually mapped all of these. There's 2,133 programs.
Whoa, get out of here. So where did they get trained to do this?
American College of Sports Medicine, Cancer Exercise Training Institute, an organization called Can Rehab. There's a broad variety of options and possibilities for training of exercise professionals and rehabilitation professionals to work with cancer patients. But you do want to work with somebody who has that specialty training. You don't want to work with a physical therapist who's an orthopedic physical therapist who doesn't understand cancer. You don't want to work with a fitness trainer who does not understand cancer. There are some very specific things that people need to know in order to effectively work with cancer patients and survivors.
I think that that is so terribly important, because one of the first things out of my mouth is, if you're a woman who's never really done strength training before, then you have absolutely got to get guidance so that you don't harm yourself. And most importantly, you could reap the benefits, because you can't reap benefits if your form isn't appropriate and if you're not being followed up appropriately either, because you constantly need feedback like, okay, do this, do that, back and forth. So I'm thrilled again. So that's Moving Through Cancer, ACSM. And that's all people have to Google to be able to find a fitness professional who is trained in this, as it were. When I say fitness professional, 9 out of 10, I mean, I want to clarify this. Are these mostly PT people? Or are they fitness?
No, actually, about 2/3 of them are exercise professionals with specialty training. And somewhere between 25% and 33% are physical therapists, occupational therapists, nurses, other professionals.
Okay. I love those 5 exercises. I mean, you just got it all down to, and I was wondering what you were going to do with arms, because that's obviously the issue specifically with lymphedema with, you know, women with breast cancer. But, you know, people have other issues too, depending upon the location of the cancer, male and female, you know, in a big way. So it sounds like you've got all these bases covered, except one little thing I want to understand. So we live today in the era of technology. So what about technology? People are going to say, hey, is there an app for that?
There is. So Anna Schwartz is a nursing researcher in Arizona who has developed an app that is on both the Apple and Android platforms, very simply called Cancer Exercise, and it's outstanding. And I highly recommend it. There's also a new online source from Mapletree Cancer Alliance. Google Mapletree Cancer Alliance. They have a new online resource that you can sign up for. The first 7 days are free. The Cancer Exercise app is free. Overall, there is no charge for using it. There are other options. There is something out there called MyVictory that developed a library of thousands of exercise videos. They call themselves Peloton for cancer survivors.
Wow.
And I'm becoming more and more involved with MyVictory. I think I might be very closely involved in MyVictory going forward and putting it on my own website. My own website, movingthroughcancer.com, you know, is associated with the book. And there are videos to guide you to do the 5 exercises that I talked about. So if you want to see them done by a professional and do them along with the professional, that can be done as well. Kevin did a fantastic job with filming those videos. They're very high quality. There's also on that website a chair exercise option, recognizing that some of our listeners are not going to have the option of doing standing squats or lunges. So my goal is to try to meet people where they are and recognize that, you know, they're going to be people who want to do CrossFit while they're going through cancer, and good on them. That's fantastic. There are people who want to do HIIT all the way through, you know, and in their survivorship. Great. That is fantastic. But, you know, I would bet that the majority of people are kind of up for a walk, and, you know, and maybe they'll pick up a weight or two. So that's what I'm trying to meet people. The majority of cancer survivors are completely sedentary. And so we're trying to just get them off the chair. Now, get up. Now, get up.
You probably have a small subset, maybe, people who have been athletes and now they have the diagnosis of cancer. You know, they're the ones you want to rein in. It's like, stop.
Yes. So chapter 16 of my book is about that in particular. Keegan Randall, for example, is a U.S. Olympian gold medalist from Pyeongchang in cross-country skiing. She was a phenom in Pyeongchang already because she was a young mother. Very unusual for a gold medalist Olympian to be a young mother. But 3 months after the Olympics, she was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And she talks in the book about her journey and about how hard it was and about the, you know, the ups and downs as she was going through chemotherapy. But we talked to, you know, an Ironman competitor. We talked to a pancreatic cancer patient who was still racing on her bike. We talked to a marathoner with brain cancer. We talked to a lymphoma patient who's at his Ironman competitions. So, you know, I worry, frankly, Pam, more about people who were athletes or are athletes at the point of diagnosis than I do about sedentary people, because they can really do themselves some damage by overdoing it coming out of their cancer treatment, because they don't recognize how much muscle they've lost and, you know, how much the treatment has affected them, and they could injure themselves coming out of this. So convincing them to back off and slowly regain what they lost is a challenge.
Yeah, that's why I said rein them in, put a muzzle on them and, you know, get the leash on and go stop. As an athlete, I can tell you right now, I'd be your most horrible patient. I would just not listen to you and say, screw this, and go out and hurt myself. You know, it's like, that's what we do. But yeah, I mentioned that for a very serious reason. And that is, there are so many people out there, I mean, who are affected by cancer. And it's not just a bunch of sedentary people. It's a lot of people who are physically active. And the way I've always looked at it is, you said it so beautifully when I asked you how you opened up your book. It's like, go where they are. So just say, I understand that this is a friggin' nightmare for you, because you've been like, you get up at 5 and you're already working out and doing your thing and you feel alive and you get that return on investment. It feels so good. And now all of a sudden you get hit with a 2x4 to your head with a cancer diagnosis. And all of a sudden it's, how do I regroup? How do I reset this whole thing? I'm not getting it. And I'm lost, very lost. That's what I hear a lot. And so just being kind and gentle and understanding the way your book is and the way you are is just about the only way to really reach deeply into where they're coming from and then to kind of begin to go forward.
There's another aspect here, though, that I think is worth bringing in, and that is the analogy of driving a car and the squeaks and rattles. So if you drive your car once a month and you hear a squeak, you hear a rattle, then you don't know if it's new, right? And you can go to the mechanic and say, there's a squeak, there's a rattle. And they're like, well, you don't even drive your car. I don't know what to say about that, right? But if you drive your car every day and you go into the, and there's a new squeak and rattle, and you go in and you can say with real certainty to the mechanic, this is new. I drive my car every day. This is new. I'm not used to this. This is something that I think we need to pay attention to. It's making a new sound. It's squeaking in a new way. The analogy is how we use our bodies. So if you, as a cancer patient, do nothing and you have a new symptom, you can go in and say, I have a new symptom. And the doctor's like, well, I don't know what to do with that, right? But if you are using your body every day and exercising every day or often, and you have some new symptom, you can go in and with some certainty say to your doctors, hey, there's something different here. Something's different. When I ran today, it took me 25 minutes to go the same distance that usually takes me 15 minutes to go. Something's wrong. Something's going on. Doctors will pay attention to that. And what we find, what we talk about in the book, is that in the case of athletes with cancer, they know that something's wrong before the doctors do.
That's right. You know, because athletes are so much more, and there's a fancy word here, get ready, introspective. They have a beautiful connection with feelings throughout their body and their mind. And so they'll know when there's a little twitch here and there and back and forth. I remember like it was yesterday, one of my patients, the marathoner, she was preparing for one, and she was just doing a 10 miler, you know, just to kind of warm up and whatever. And she felt pain in her back. She said, no, that's no. She went in and it turned out she had been diagnosed with breast cancer years before. She was a BRCA positive. She had the breast cancer gene, unfortunately, and it had now metastasized to her spine. And that's how she found out. And most, a lot of people just blow it off like, you know, probably slept the wrong way. Or no, she knew. She knew something was wrong, got on it immediately. And, you know, they were able to intervene very positively, which was great. But what I worry about is in the mass majority of the demographic is men and women, that people are dissociated from their bodies these days. You know, they walk around with a brain and then everything from their neck on down is a big black box. It's like, whatever. They're not paying attention. They're dissociated. Many times they feel so unfit. And you know the statistics as well as I do. They're actually right. They're very unfit, oftentimes overweight or obese, and they just don't want to know. So it becomes the black box. So when something feels funkadelic, they're in denial. They're like, nah, nothing happened. Okay, so they do the exact opposite of what an athlete would do, and they blow it off until you can't blow it off anymore. So that's another, you know, as we're unpacking all of this, there's so many challenges. And this is why I cannot tell you, I fell to my knees with gratitude when you published your book, Moving Through Cancer, an exercise and strength training program for the fight of your life. It blew me away because now we finally had evidence-based information delivered in a loving, kind way, welcoming people to their own body. Hi, here's your body. And now we're going to take care of it because you now have had a wake-up call. It involved your body. And we're now going to go from there. That's our starting point. And if that's the way the whole reconnection between mind and body happens, well, so be it. Maybe, you know, in the midst of difficulty lies opportunity. And so that's kind of the way I look at it. And I just can't thank you, your research teams, and all the years you've dedicated to this entire topic, because this was so sorely needed. And as a provider, I can tell you right now, it was driving me crazy. It's a short drive. When I had nothing to offer people other than maybe some kind of sort of conjecture and early studies, but nobody had a system around it. Now you've developed a system and have become an internationally renowned expert in this field, which is why I dragged you onto the HER podcast so that you could share this unbelievably important information with so many of our audience who have been yelling and screaming for this for a long time because they were desperate. So for that, we're deeply grateful, Katie.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's such an important thing for me and my work for there to be a paradigm shift and for us to really, if I might, for us to pass the Uber test. And what I mean by that is, you know, I travel internationally. I travel all over the world, all over the country. And I get in Ubers all the time and they say, what do you do? And I say, I do research on exercise and cancer. And I always get funny looks and, you know, what does exercise have to do with cancer? You know, why would you do that? What would be the connection between exercise and cancer? And so the Uber test for me is, you know, I want, before I graduate from my current roles, which is not soon, I would like to get an Uber and say, I do exercise in cancer. Have somebody say, oh, yes, I heard that that's important.
I love it. Well, you know what I've called it forever? It's the beauty salon test. If your manicurist, your hairdresser can immediately say, oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I've read the book. I heard all about it. Actually, I referred a couple friends. And I think that it's because they know. So it's finally trickled down. Once it gets to that level, you're like, I'm in. We're here. You know, we have arrived. Well, speaking of arrived, we're departing now. Honestly, Katie, I could talk to you forever and a day. Just such tremendous gratitude for everything you do. Everyone, we've been talking to Dr. Catherine Schmitz, my dear, dear friend, University of Pittsburgh in the medical school, who's done this pivotal work in the relationship between cancer and exercise. Please check out her book and her website, Moving Through Cancer, an exercise and strength training program for the fight of your life. This is going to empower patients and caregivers in 5 steps. And then also go to Moving Through Cancer, the website itself, so that you can actually see some of the videos and the exercises themselves and be able to learn more about Dr. Schmitz's absolutely pivotal and groundbreaking work. So for that, I can't thank you enough, Katie.
Thank you for the invitation. It was great to catch up with you a little bit, Pam.
All right, run on over, everyone out there. I see you. You know, go to iTunes right now, rate and review this terrific episode. I want to hear your feedback right now. That's a command. And here's another shout out to our sponsor, Solaray Vitamins. And remember the Her Life Stages products. You got to get them. This is going to take care of your entire hormonal journey naturally, as they say. Run on over to Solaray.com. Use promo code HER20. Get on over to your local health food store. Whole Foods, it's everywhere. You'll be happy. Hey, listen, join me every week for another Her podcast where you're going to hear from extraordinary, entertaining, and engaging thought leaders like Dr. Katie Schmitz as we share our wit and wisdom for you to enjoy. Thanks so much. And remember, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there and seize the day. Come on now. Have a great one.